Imagine sitting on your couch, right? You're just staring at your phone.
Yeah, a pretty standard evening.
Exactly. The workday is over, the house is completely quiet, and you're just physically resting. Your eyes are open, your thumb is moving, smoothly across the glass. But a brain scan taken in this exact moment would show something absolutely terrifying.
It really would.
It would show that the most advanced human part of your brain, the prefrontal cortex, has actually fallen asleep. Like you are quite literally a biological zombie.
Which is a terrifying concept to actually picture.
It is. And well, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're exploring a monumental and honestly highly unsettling collection of sources spanning cognitive science, media theory, clinical psychology, and even something called fractal philosophy.
Yeah, it's a massive integration of disciplines.
Right. And our mission for this deep dive is to really understand the profound reality that your very perception of the world, what we might call your inner signal, is being, well, systematically hijacked by digital noise.
And crucially, we are going to look at the cognitive framework these sources provide to actually help you get your mind back.
Exactly, because we hear these warnings all the time. But the goal here is to make sure that by the time you finish listening to this deep dive, you're going to understand the exact biological and psychological mechanisms being weaponized against your attention.
Yeah, it really is an invisible crisis. I mean, when you synthesize the data from these clinical researchers and the media theorists, it becomes overwhelmingly clear.
Right.
We are dealing with something far, far more severe than just, a generic warning about screen time.
Like, oh, put your phone down before bed. It's not just that.
Exactly. It's not that. It's an ambient, continuous frequency that completely permeates our daily consciousness. The very architecture of your mind is being systemically destabilized.
Wow.
Yeah. We are caught in this psychological multiverse, right? Just suspended helplessly between the organic reality of our physical lived experience and the highly engineered, entirely frictionless environment of the digital sphere.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit because we need to look at the foundation of this entire system. We hear the term attention economy thrown around all the time, right? Like it's a buzzword.
Oh, absolutely. Everyone says it.
But the sources argue that this digital environment doesn't just reflect what we happen to be interested in, it actively sculpts our preferences, our thoughts, and our behavior.
Yes.
And it does this through something called microscopic behavioral telemetry, which sounds intense.
It is intense because most people assume data collection just means, an algorithm tracking your search history or your age or your general location.
Right, like targeted ads for shoes because you Googled shoes.
Exactly. But microscopic behavioral telemetry operates on a neurophysical level that is, frankly, deeply intimate. It involves algorithms measuring your scrolling speeds down to the actual millisecond.
Wait, really? The millisecond?
Oh, yeah. They track your dwell times, literally how long your retinas linger on a specific cluster of pixels on the screen.
That is just wild.
And they map your micro hesitations. So, say your thumb hovers over a video of, I don't know, a political argument for an extra 300 milliseconds before you decide to keep scrolling.
Okay.
That tiny hesitation is captured, it's cataloged, and it's immediately fed back into a predictive model.
So it knows you almost watched it.
Exactly. Through this really granular, relentless tracking, your attention is no longer just a natural cognitive state. It has been transformed into an engineered, extractable resource.
Right. And that phrase from the material really stuck with me, that attention is the currency of the soul.
It's a heavy phrase, yeah.
That is, because it frames attention not as this passive state where you're just idly staring at a screen, but as the active mechanism of your consciousness. Like when we give our attention over to these algorithmic loops, we are essentially surrendering our sovereignty over our own perception.
We really are.
So, okay, let's use a real-world scenario to make sense of this. Imagine you go to a mall, right? You think you're just window shopping, strolling past the displays. You feel like you're in total control of where you walk.
Right, you're just browsing.
Yeah, just browsing. But in this digital environment, it's as if the window is physically studying your pupil dilation. It's mapping the micro expressions on your face and then generating a totally customized hook to literally drag you inside the store by the collar.
That's a perfect analogy.
But I do have to push back just a little here. Are we sure hijacking is the right word?
What do you mean?
Well, is it really a deliberate hostile takeover? Or is it just, companies building incredibly efficient products to show us what we like so we don't get bored? Like, isn't that just good business?
Well, what's fascinating here is that the clinical researchers driving these studies, they don't mince words about this. They consider hijacking entirely accurate.
Really? They use that term?
Yeah, because they operate using a specific clinical term for this whole system.
Yeah.
The algorithmic dopamine economy.
The algorithmic dopamine economy. Okay.
Right. The infrastructure of these platforms isn't just a friendly concierge trying to find you a good video to pass the time. It is an opaque, highly engineered cycle of prediction and variable reinforcement.
Variable reinforcement.
Exactly. The underlying mechanics perfectly mirror the established principles of operant conditioning. It's the exact same psychological levers used to create actual substance dependency in humans.
Wow. So it's not about making us happy.
No, not at all. The ultimate objective is not user satisfaction. The objective is the absolute total monopolization of your visual and cognitive real estate.
Which means we aren't dealing with an economy of dollars and cents anymore, right?
Right.
We are dealing with an economy that runs entirely on our neurobiology.
That's exactly it.
If this system is fundamentally bankrupting our attention,
yeah,
we have to really look under the biological hood to see exactly how this bankruptcy happens.
Yes, we need to get into the physical brain.
Right, which leads us directly into the neuroscience of what the internet colloquially calls brain rot.
I love that term. It's so visceral.
It really is. Mm-hmm. And to understand this brain rot, the text breaks down a concept called RPE, or reward prediction errors.
Yeah, and this is crucial because we have to fundamentally rethink how we talk about dopamine.
Right, because usually we just think of it as the happy chemical, right?
Exactly. In popular culture, dopamine is almost always described as a pleasure chemical. Like you eat a piece of chocolate, you get a hit of joy. That's dopamine.
Right.
But in actual neuroscience, dopamine functions primarily as a teaching signal.
The teaching signal.
Yeah, it encodes the reward prediction error. Mm-hmm. Think of it like a biological discrepancy between what you expect to happen in your environment and what actually happens.
Okay, so if I expect something good and something better happens.
Exactly. In the natural world, if you expect a certain outcome, but you encounter a reward that drastically exceeds that expectation, your dopamine spikes.
Got it.
It's the brain's internal machinery basically shouting, hey, pay attention to exactly what you just did, map the variables, remember it, and do it again.
So it's an evolutionary thing.
Entirely. It is a primal mechanism designed for adaptive learning and survival.
Okay, so normally, your dopamine system is like a perfectly calibrated thermostat, right?
Yeah.
It spikes to tell you to remember a good behavior, and then it resets back to a baseline room temperature.
That's how it should work, yes.
But when you apply that evolutionary mechanism to an algorithmic feed, it seems like the thermostat just gets completely obliterated.
It absolutely does. Because the infinite scroll and the autoplay features, they create this frictionless environment completely devoid of natural stopping cues.
Right. There's no bottom to the page anymore.
Exactly. But more importantly, they provide variable, unpredictable rewards.
Okay. So how does that look when you're scrolling?
Well, you swipe up on your phone, right? And you might get a mundane video of someone cooking a meal.
Boring.
Right. You swipe again. Another boring video. You swipe a third time, and suddenly you are hit with a video that makes you laugh hysterically, or worse, makes you viscerally angry.
Right. It's just random.
It feels random. Your brain can never habituate to the pattern because there is deliberately no pattern. Every single swipe is a pull on a slot machine.
Wow.
And because the brain never knows when that high arousal reward is coming, it is constantly subjected to this artificial, relentless barrage of novel stimuli.
And just like someone rapidly twisting that thermostat dial from freezing to boiling every 3 seconds, eventually the HVAC system just burns out.
Oh, gives out, yeah.
The sources describe this as reward saturation and tolerance. And it mimics physical substance dependency perfectly, doesn't it?
To a T.
So over time, a mild joke or a beautiful sunset or just a simple story doesn't even register on your emotional radar anymore. You need increasingly extreme algorithmic novelty just to feel a baseline level of mental engagement.
You're just trying to feel normal at that point.
Exactly. But the exhaustion doesn't stop at the dopamine receptors, right? Because this constant bombardment leads to severe cognitive overload, specifically targeting the prefrontal cortex.
Right. And the prefrontal cortex is the seat of your executive function. It manages self-control, long-term planning, and conscious decision-making.
All the higher-level human stuff.
All the stuff that makes us human. When you are rapidly context-shifting, so jumping from a funny meme to a tragic news story to a highly produced advertisement, All in the span of 12 seconds, you are absolutely maxing out your brain's working memory capacity.
It's just too much data.
It is. You are forcing the prefrontal cortex to process wildly different emotional and intellectual contexts at a speed that human biology was just never designed to handle.
Which brings us to the concept of ego depletion.
Yeah.
And I want to clarify, it's not about your actual ego, like your pride, right?
Not at all.
It's a state of catastrophic self-regulatory failure. Your brain literally runs out of the metabolic energy required for effortful, controlled decision-making.
You're just running on empty.
Right. You shift from being a deliberate actor in your own life to being entirely impulsive. And this is where we circle back to that terrifying concept we opened the show with, local sleep.
Here is where it gets really interesting. The neurophysiological reality of ego depletion is staggering.
Okay, tell me about this.
Functional imaging studies actually demonstrate that when the prefrontal cortex is severely exhausted by this constant digital strain, specific neural networks within that region actually exhibit sleep-like activity.
Wait, hold on. Sleep-like activity?
Yeah.
While you're awake?
Yes. The individual remains completely physically awake. Their eyes are open, they are breathing, they are actively interacting with the device. But the cognitive centers that govern willpower have literally powered down to recover.
That is just mind-blowing to me. Like, you are staring at your screen and the most human part of your brain is literally taking a nap.
Taking a nap while you're scrolling.
And if the prefrontal cortex is asleep at the wheel, who's driving the car?
Well, the brain executes this brilliant, albeit deeply destructive, survival mechanism. It hands control over to the basal ganglia.
The basal ganglia.
Right. And the basal ganglia is an evolutionarily older region of the brain. It governs automated habits, rolled routines, and low-energy behaviors.
So it's like the autopilot.
It's pure autopilot. It doesn't require conscious thought or ethical deliberation or long-term planning. It just executes established patterns.
Wow. So when we talk about zombie scrolling, we aren't using a metaphor here. We are describing a literal biological handover of power.
It is entirely literal.
You lose conscious volition. You're just trapped in this bottomless bowl of content, utterly unable to disengage. And the sources know that people often describe feeling a growing sense of, like, internal dysphoria and mental friction during these sessions.
Yeah,
right?
The feeling of, I need to stop.
Exactly. They know they should put the phone down. They want to go to sleep. They feel gross. But they physically cannot stop their thumb from swiping.
Because the basal ganglia has taken the wheel.
Man. And this measurable decline in executive functioning, this profound emotional desensitization, this is what the clinical texts are validating as literal brain rot.
And to make matters worse, we really have to look at what the basal ganglia is actually feeding on during these scrolling sessions.
Like the content itself.
Yes. The algorithms are optimized to prioritize emotionally hyper-stimulating content. We're talking outrage, anxiety, tribalism, fear.
Because that gets the most clicks.
Exactly. And this completely hijacks the brain's salience network.
Okay, what does the salience network do normally?
Under normal circumstances, the salience network filters environmental stimuli to help us focus on what's genuinely important for our physical survival.
Like spotting a predator.
Right. But in the digital ecosystem, it gets continually bombarded by synthetic threats.
So the brain is just constantly reacting to these fake emergencies.
Yes. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the brain is learning a very dangerous lesson here. It's learning that subtlety is meaningless. Nuance is irrelevant. Only extreme heightened arousal matters.
It's a complete rewiring of our internal value system. Like, we aren't just getting tired. Our brains are being actively conditioned to believe that the quiet, mundane moments of real life are completely devoid of value.
Which is tragic, honestly.
It is. And if our brains are physically changing, it stands to reason our minds, our personalities, our actual sense of self are fracturing along with them.
They absolutely are.
If we look at the environmentally induced psychopathologies outlined in these materials, we see exactly how this manifests. The first major pathology they identify is digital dissociation.
Right. And we need to differentiate this because when we talk about dissociation in classical psychology, we're usually describing a severe protective defense mechanism that the mind deploys to survive acute trauma.
Right, like an out-of-body experience during an accident.
Exactly. But digital dissociation operates on a different spectrum entirely. It manifests as a chronic, low-grade detachment from one's own emotional and bodily experience.
A low-grade detachment.
Yes. And it is directly induced by prolonged immersion in these digital environments. The person is, say, physically sitting at the dinner table with their family, but their consciousness is caught in a liminal space.
Right.
The material uses a fantastic word for this. They say the person is buffering.
Buffering. Oh, it's such a perfect description because you can literally see it in people's eyes.
You really can.
They are physically occupying space in the room, but they just aren't there. The text points out that we largely use the digital interface not to process reality, but to aggressively avoid the discomfort of the present moment.
Yes, we flee into the screen.
We have become utterly terrified of silence.
Mm.
And this chronic avoidance leads to what the researchers call affective hyperresonance.
Right.
Which is just this sustained, palpable sense of inner emptiness. You just feel flat. It breeds offline anhedonia, which basically means you lose the biological capability to find joy in the physical world.
And a secondary, deeply concerning effect of this buffering state is the development of alexithymic tendencies.
Alexithymia. Okay, break that down for us.
Alexithymia is a clinical condition characterized by the inability to recognize, label, and verbalize one's own emotional states.
So you don't know what you're feeling.
Exactly. And because the digital environment completely lacks physical nuance, I mean, there is no thermal presence, no shared breathing, no proprioceptive grounding, no actual eye contact. The brain's somatosensory integration circuits are systematically suppressed.
Wait, hold on. Somatosensory integration circuits. Let's make sure we're crystal clear on this.
Yeah.
You mean literally just our brain's ability to sync up what we touch, what we see, and what we feel in our actual physical bodies?
Precisely that. Your brain naturally relies on physical cues to contextualize emotions.
Right.
But because you are spending hours absorbing highly emotional content through a completely flat piece of glass, while your physical body remains completely static, those circuits atrophy.
Wow.
You become entirely estranged from your own internal signal. You can feel a tightness in your chest, but you literally forget how to identify whether that feeling is guilt or loneliness or just algorithmic anxiety. You forget how to feel your own body.
So your body is completely numb, and simultaneously, your attention is shattered into a million fragments.
It's a paradox, yeah.
The sources identify this as continuous partial attention disorder, or CPAD. And this isn't just being distracted. It is a state of perpetual hypervigilant monitoring.
Yes, you're always on watch.
You are keeping a low-level, exhausting watch on multiple digital streams at all times. You never fully commit your focus to a single task or a single conversation or a single moment of genuine rest.
You're spread incredibly thin.
Right. And because you are never fully at rest, you develop digital anxiety disorder, or DAD, where your anxiety becomes inextricably linked to digital metrics and phantom notifications.
Yeah, checking your pocket when the phone didn't even buzz.
Exactly. The device itself becomes both the primary source of your stress and the false remedy you compulsively reach for to soothe it.
It is a closed-loop trap. But perhaps the most alarming pathology explored in these sources is reactive narrative overexpression syndrome, or RNOS.
Yes, RNOS.
And to understand RNOS, we really have to look at what the researchers call the narrative dopamine heuristic.
Okay, let's really dig into this RNOS concept because this absolutely blew my mind.
It's fascinating.
The sources suggest that because we are living in an environment governed by algorithms that explicitly reward peak emotional volatility,
yeah,
people literally lose the ability to process silence or nuance.
Right.
Like, people who are raised in these attention deserts learn very quickly that the only way to feel seen or to get that dopamine hit of engagement is to mimic the loudest, most aggressive scream in the room.
You have to outrage the outrage.
Exactly. They internalize the toxic algorithm. Mm. They effectively become the synthetic noise that is tormenting them. Now, human beings naturally learn to regulate their emotions in childhood, right? Through facial attunement, physical warmth, caregivers soothing them.
Yes, co-regulation.
Right, co-regulation. But if I'm understanding this right, the algorithm is stepping into that role.
Mm.
We are allowing a machine to train our limbic system to react exclusively to aggression. So are we essentially outsourcing our emotional regulation to a server farm?
This raises an important question, and the answer is yes. We are outsourcing our emotional regulation, and by extension, we are outsourcing our human resilience. Our psychological immunity is eroding at an unprecedented rate. Historically, human beings built a robust inner architecture to deal with hardship, grief, complexity.
Right, we had mechanisms for that.
We did this through organic silence, deep introspective reflection, and relying on physical community. But today, opaque machine logic preemptively prescribes our emotional responses.
So it tells us how to feel before we even feel it.
Exactly. When you feel a pang of anxiety or a wave of boredom, and you immediately open an app to soothe it, you bypass the internal work.
You don't let the emotion play out.
No, you abort the process. You lose the vital opportunity to cultivate independent introspective strategies. You lose the profound human ability to simply sit in silence and actually process what you're feeling.
It's like we're allowing an algorithm to chew up and digest our emotions for us, but it only regurgitates the toxic byproducts back into our mouths.
That's a very vivid way to put it, but yes.
But here's the critical pivot. If the individual human psyche is fracturing into these extreme, algorithmically prescribed reactions, what happens on a macro level?
That's where it gets dangerous.
Right. What happens when you take 3 billion of these fragmented, emotionally outsourced minds and plug them into the exact same network, trying to agree on what is real?
We reach a state of macroscopic societal collapse.
Collapse.
Yes. Which brings us to the sociological framework provided by the sources, drawing heavily on Jean Baudrillard's concept of hyperreality.
Okay, Baudrillard, let's get into this.
Baudrillard famously mapped out the third order of simulacra. To grasp this, think about the relationship between a map and a territory.
Okay.
In the past, a simulation like a painting or a map imitated reality. The territory was real, the map was just a representation of it.
Right, the map isn't the actual dirt.
Exactly. But in the third order of simulacra, signs, images, and media no longer correspond to an external truth at all. They generate a self-referential loop.
So the map references another map.
Essentially, the simulation doesn't just imitate reality, it actively competes with it and eventually replaces it. And in our current era of AI, we have crossed fully into this domain.
We are talking about multimodal AIGC, right? Artificial intelligence generated content.
Exactly.
We have reached an era of photorealistic deepfakes, perfectly cloned voices, and entirely synthetic personas that are engineered to be flawless. And these fabrications are so hyper-realistic that they hold significantly more emotional and ideological weight for people than the actual boring truth.
Because the truth is messy.
It is. And the texts point out that the early internet was largely just an information cocoon, right? A place where you gravitated toward things you already agreed with.
And an echo chamber.
But that cocoon has metastasized into what they call a poison chamber. Platforms actively monetize our attention through outrage, which means they deliberately amplify hallucinatory synthetic narratives because those generate the most clicks.
And the immediate consequence of this poison chamber is a phenomenon the text refers to as the Kenny effect.
The Kenny effect.
Yes. This represents the absolute weaponization of hyperreality. It's a specific brand of online defamation where digital actors utilize these flawless simulations. So, fabricated chat logs, perfectly cloned synthetic audio, manipulated likenesses to effortlessly synthesize evidence.
They just create fake proof.
Out of thin air, they can destroy reputations, dismantle the foundations of credibility, and burn down institutional and social capital overnight.
Because it looks so real.
Exactly. When citizens can no longer trust the evidence of their own eyes and ears, the basic societal trust required for a functioning civilization simply evaporates.
So what does this actually mean for us on a Tuesday morning? Let me distill the terrifying reality of the Kenny effect for you.
Please do.
If a fake audio clip of you saying something horrific can be generated flawlessly in 10 seconds, it means truth is no longer something we can just verify with our senses.
Right.
The age-old adage that seeing is believing is completely dead, and the text describes the result of this as the uncanny thinness of modern life.
Uncanny thinness.
Yeah. Everything you look at online feels templated. Everything feels artificially smoothed over. You develop this sensation of existential deja vu, right? A constant familiarity that is utterly devoid of true resonance or soul.
It's all surface.
Exactly. This isn't just a debate about fake news anymore. It is a profound, visceral, existential dislocation.
And it's a dislocation that generates immense psychological grief.
Grief.
Yes, grief. The sources emphasize that the modern mind is caught in a brutal tug of war. On one side, you have the organic, physical reality of human suffering, which is chaotic, visceral, and very real.
Right.
On the other side, you have the frictionless, algorithmic, hyper-curated delivery of simulated content. This massive dissonance between what we feel in our bones and what we see on our screens creates what the text calls spiritual vertigo.
Spiritual vertigo.
The overarching myths, The cultural narratives and the shared emotional scaffolding that previously gave human life, meaning the structures that converted the chaos of the world into order, they are violently stripped away. The soul is left entirely vulnerable and unanchored.
Spiritual vertigo. You just can't find solid ground because the ground itself is constantly shifting into a newly generated simulation.
You're always falling.
So this presents a massive problem.
Yeah.
If we can no longer trust the external world, and if intellectual fact-checking is practically useless against flawless AI simulations, where do we find the truth?
That is the ultimate question.
Right. How do we ground ourselves when the map has completely eaten the territory? Well, the sources propose that the only way out is a radical philosophical shift. We are diving into the ontological shift presented in the texts Fractal the Trilogy and the Oracle 2.0.
This is where the sources transition from diagnosing the pathology of the modern world to offering a profound systemic paradigm shift.
Okay, let's get into it.
The fractal philosophy asserts a radical claim. Reality is not just a collection of static, dead matter that we passively observe.
It's not just stuff out there.
Right. The universe is a recursive, highly responsive, living system of information and consciousness. The texts utilize a conceptual framework called the Trinity Monument to explain this architecture.
The Trinity Monument, what are the three parts?
The Trinity consists of the source, which represents pure, infinite potential. Then consciousness, which is the light or the mechanism of projection, and finally the space-time membrane, which is the physical foundation where that projection takes actual form.
Okay.
In this deeply quantum worldview, reality remains in a state of pure probability until the precise moment of conscious observation. Observation collapses probability into a specific timeline.
The observer builds the world.
Exactly.
I love the way the text frames this. It says that a mountain isn't just a physical structure of dead rock. It is the projection of our own awakening.
It's beautiful.
Attention is not just a flashlight we shine on things, you know.
Yeah.
Attention is highly participatory. It is the literal mechanism of creation.
Yes.
Which means to survive this era of hyper-reality, we have to fundamentally redefine what truth even is.
Yes.
Truth cannot be a static data point on Wikipedia or an algorithmic consensus achieved by millions of bots in an echo chamber.
No, it can't.
The text defines truth as lived coherence. It is a frequency. It's an internal alignment between the heart, the mind, and the soul. It is something that is felt deeply in the body before it is ever proven on a screen.
To rely entirely on algorithmic validation or external hyperreal metrics is to willfully abandon your inner compass.
You're giving away your power.
Entirely. And this is why the sources argue a point that might surprise some people. Spiritual awakening is no longer just an esoteric luxury reserved for monks sitting in a monastery.
It's not just a hobby anymore.
No. In the age of AI and the attention economy, spiritual grounding is a strategic, non-negotiable necessity for basic psychological survival. You have to deeply internalize the concept that your perception is a lens, not a law.
Okay, I have to jump in here, because while I love the philosophy, I can hear people listening to this and thinking it sounds incredibly abstract.
Sure, it can sound very lofty.
Let's ground this.
Yeah.
If I am driving to work, right, I'm late for a meeting, and I am stuck in gridlock traffic on the highway.
Yeah.
I didn't project that traffic. Yeah. The traffic is a physical reality of metal and asphalt, and it is causing me very real stress. How does this fractal philosophy of the observer building the world actually apply in the context of the attention economy and my messy, frustrating daily life?
What's fascinating here is that the sources, they don't deny the physical reality of the traffic or the cars or the concrete.
Okay.
They aren't suggesting you hallucinated the highway. They argue that while you cannot control the external barrage of information or the physical gridlock around you, you possess absolute sovereign authority over the lens of your attention.
The lens.
Right. How you observe that traffic fundamentally alters your internal reality, which dictates your physiological and psychological response.
But my reaction is my creation.
Exactly. If you identify entirely with the erratic, algorithmically induced noise of your mind, you know, the frustration, the road rage, the anxiety about your boss, you completely abdicate your sovereign role as a creator.
You're just reacting.
You're a victim to the stimulus. Now scale that up. If 3 billion minds are synchronized by digital platforms to focus exclusively on fear, division, and outrage, the collective dream we are projecting onto the space-time membrane becomes a waking nightmare.
Wow.
Reclaiming the lens of your attention is how you stop ghostwriting your existence through an algorithm. It's how you step back from the knee-jerk reaction regulate your nervous system, and consciously choose your focus.
I see. So we're essentially being coerced into collectively manifesting a fractured, highly toxic reality simply because our attention is being harvested and pointed in the wrong direction.
That's the core thesis, yes.
Which makes reclaiming our attention the ultimate act of rebellion.
It really is.
But philosophy only provides the mindset, right? It gives us the overarching view from 30,000 feet. How do we physically, practically, in our day-to-day lives, defend our inner architecture against an AI-driven dopamine economy backed by billions of dollars of research?
We need actionable steps.
We need a system.
Yeah.
We need concrete, undeniable steps. And that is exactly what the sources provide with the antidote, the Signal Protocol.
The Signal Protocol is a rigorous daily methodology meticulously designed to transition humanity out of the extractive attention economy and into what the authors call the intention economy.
The intention economy, I like that.
It is built upon 8 foundational pillars, and it is crucial to stress upfront that this is not a casual weekend digital detox where you just put your phone in a drawer for a few hours.
It's not a temporary fix.
No, it is a complete structural redesign of how your consciousness interacts with reality.
Okay, let's walk through these 8 pillars and really look at what they demand of us. Pillar 1, attention boundaries. The text talks about creating physical and temporal Faraday cages for the mind. Now, in electronics, a Faraday cage is a physical enclosure that blocks all electromagnetic signals. In the context of the Signal Protocol, it means creating absolute non-negotiable boundaries in your home and your schedule, where no notifications, no internet, and no devices are allowed to bleed into sacred spaces.
Like the bedroom, for example.
Exactly, the bedroom. You are deliberately halting the constant context switching that exhausts the prefrontal cortex.
Setting those physical boundaries is step 1, but pillar 2 is where the neurological rewiring actually happens, information fasting.
Information fasting?
Yes. This involves implementing extended halts. We're talking 24 hours or more on all non-essential digital intake.
Wow.
The biological mechanism behind this is what matters. By removing the variable rewards of the feed, you are intentionally starving the basal ganglia.
Starving the zombie brain.
Exactly. You are forcing the brain to undergo a period of reward desaturation, which gives your downregulated dopamine receptors the time and silence they need to organically recalibrate to baseline levels.
I have to be honest. Information fasting sounds incredibly difficult for someone living a modern life.
It's grueling.
The sources don't sugarcoat this at all. They mention that people going through this initial fasting experience, intense restlessness, spikes in anxiety, and severe affective withdrawal.
Because it's an addiction.
Right. If your brain is used to a dopamine slot machine, stopping cold turkey is going to hurt. You are literally going through digital withdrawal to cure that anhedonia we talked about, that inability to feel joy in normal everyday things like drinking a cup of coffee or listening to a bird.
You have to push through the pain.
You have to aggressively endure the boredom to reset your brain. But okay, if I do this 24-hour fast and I suffer through the withdrawal, Monday morning rolls around and I still have to look at my phone and my computer for work. How do I stop the basal ganglia from taking over the second I open my email?
That is exactly why the protocol moves to pillar 3, conscious media intake. Fasting resets the baseline, but conscious media intake dictates how you re-enter the digital space. You begin to treat digital information exactly the way a high-performance athlete treats biological nutrition. You no longer passively consume whatever the algorithm serves you.
You become a conscious consumer.
Yes. Before you engage with an article, a video, or an app, you force a moment of conscious friction and ask a filtering question.
Like what?
Like, does this piece of media amplify fear or love? Am I observing this to awaken to the world, or am I using this hyper-stimulating content to aggressively escape my own present moment? You actively reject the sensationalist hyper-reality by consciously choosing not to consume it.
And when you do choose to consume information, you apply pillar 4, discernment rituals.
Right.
We've already established that intellectual fact-checking is a losing game against flawless AI deepfakes. You just can't outthink a supercomputer.
It's impossible.
So instead, the protocol instructs you to rely on your somatic bodily responses. When you are reading a highly charged political article or watching a viral video, what does your physical body actually do?
Where do you feel it?
Does your chest tighten? Do you feel a sudden engineered spike of cortisol and adrenaline? Or does the information bring a sense of grounded, steady clarity? You have to relearn how to use the deep evolutionary intelligence of your physical body to detect the manipulation hidden inside the synthetic noise.
And reconnecting with the body naturally leads to pillar five, silence.
Silence.
Yes, and it is critical to understand that silence in this protocol is not defined merely as the absence of acoustic noise. It is defined as the active presence of the real.
The active presence of the real.
It is a dedicated daily space where your mental architecture is given the room to process the massive accumulated cognitive load of the day. This is the specific mechanism by which you heal the digital dissociation we explored earlier.
So you stop buffering.
Exactly. By simply sitting in stillness without a device buffering your reality, you allow the fractured, overwhelmed pieces of your identity to integrate back into your physical body.
And to help process that silent integration, the protocol introduces pillar six, journaling. But there is a massive caveat here. It must be analog handwriting.
Pen and paper.
Yes. By using a physical pen and actual paper, you are externalizing your thoughts and bypassing the digital interface entirely. You aren't typing on a keyboard that is secretly tracking your keystroke speed.
It's untrackable.
The text describes this practice as mapping your own inner garden without algorithmically mimicking the toxic noise you've consumed. The physical act of writing slows down the mind and helps you reclaim your authentic narrative voice.
Which brings us to repairing the interpersonal damage caused by the attention economy with pillar seven, deep listening.
This one is so important.
It is the practice of giving your absolute, undivided, sovereign attention to another human being or to nature. It means sitting across from someone with no phones on the table, no smartwatches vibrating on your wrist.
Just actual eye contact.
And not preemptively planning your response while they're speaking. This profound level of presence rebuilds the thermal connection and somatosensory integration that the digital world strips away.
It grounds you back in the room.
It directly heals the empathy-eroding effects of the hyperreal void by firmly grounding you in shared physical reality.
And finally, we reach pillar eight, values-based filtering. This is the ultimate firewall for your consciousness.
The last line of defense.
This pillar requires subordinating every single digital engagement to your core spiritual and ethical truths. It means developing the profound, unshakable discipline to simply walk away from platforms, apps, or social circles that explicitly optimize for outrage.
You just leave.
If a platform feeds the algorithms of division, paranoia, and fear, you deny it your attention, which we now know is the single most valuable currency in the universe.
When you zoom out and look at the systemic impact of these eight pillars, you realize they are the practical mechanics of how you step completely out of Baudrillard's hyperreality and re-enter a state of lived coherence.
You exit the simulation.
You are doing far more than just turning off your phone. You are actively, rigorously securing the perimeter of your consciousness. You are taking back the lens.
It is a complete reclamation of the self. So let's take a breath and briefly recap the incredible journey we've taken today.
It's been a lot of ground covered.
We started by looking at the microscopic telemetry, the invisible trackers measuring our hesitations and eye movements that hijack our dopamine systems and literally force the executive centers of our brains into a state of local sleep.
Right.
We explored how that biological hijacking leads to the fracturing of our individual psyche, creating a society that is trapped in a hyperreal void where truth is dismantled by synthetic AI simulations.
Uncanny effect.
Exactly. And finally, we arrived at the profound, empowering realization that we are not passive victims in this matrix. We are the active architects of our reality. Armed with the rigorous boundaries of the signal protocol, we can rebuild our inner architecture.
Navigating the transition from a passive algorithmic consumer to an awakened sovereign architect of reality is undeniably the defining challenge of our era.
I completely agree.
And as we conclude this deep dive, there is a final lingering idea extending from these sources that I want to leave you with.
What's that?
Consider the very next time you reach into your pocket and pull your phone out today. In that microsecond before the glass screen illuminates, pause and ask yourself one singular defining question.
Okay.
Are you looking at this device to awaken to the world, or are you using it to escape the silence of your own mind? Because in that specific microscopic fraction of a second, the entire battle for the sovereignty of your perception is won or lost.
That is an incredibly powerful thought to carry forward into your day.
Yeah.
We want to thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Before you rush off to your next task or reflexively open your next feed, we challenge you to take just one moment of deliberate, unbroken silence. Let the synthetic noise fade. Find your own inner signal. Until next time.